UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Research shows the opportunity to achieve transplant is especially vital for HIV-positive patients. HIV-positive patients on dialysis have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, infection complications, and mortality, which is 5 to 15% for HIV-positive patients, depending on other comorbidities. My guest today is Dr. Jamie Locke. She's the director of the HIV transplant program at UAB Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Locke. What's changed since the discovery of HIV and AIDS in the 1980s?
Well, in the mid-1990s, we introduced highly active antiretroviral therapy. And when we did that, we saw a dramatic decline in the number of AIDS cases, a dramatic decline in the number of AIDS-related deaths, and an increase in the prevalence of HIV. And what that really means is that we began to see that people were living longer. And so instead of dying from AIDS, HIV-infected individuals really became like anybody else with a chronic, well-treated disease. And that is that they were living much longer lives and were at risk for developing other comorbid conditions. So instead of dying from things like opportunistic infections that were very classic of AIDS, HIV-infected individuals began to have mortality rates that were related to other forms of disease such as chronic kidney disease. And in fact, chronic diseases like end-stage renal disease have now surpassed opportunistic infections as the leading cause of death among HIV-infected individuals.
That's really very interesting. So what has typically been done for an HIV-positive patient should they need a transplant?
Well, historically, most places did not offer transplant to HIV-infected individuals. And there was a lot of concern about further immunosuppressing a patient population that in theory is already immunosuppressed as a result of the HIV virus. However, there are a lot of people that felt like that we could do more. One of those individuals, a colleague of mine named Peter Stock at the University of California at San Francisco, and Peter put together an NIH-funded prospective clinical trial in which we went about transplanting highly selected HIV-infected individuals with end-stage renal disease. And we were able to demonstrate in that trial for the first time that HIV-infected individuals could be safely transplanted and that they got relatively good outcomes. And in fact, their outcomes were similar to patients from the general transplant population that did not have HIV but were older or over the age of 65. And once we did that, we really began to gain some traction in the transplant community for offering transplant to these individuals.
So speak about the viability of organs to be transplanted into HIV-infected patients from HIV-infected donors.
Well, before we got to that, I think just to say, when we first started doing this, all of the transplants that were done in HIV-infected patients were done utilizing kidneys from HIV-negative donors. And the reason for that is because the National Organ Transplant Act that was passed in 1984 and revised in 1988, when that was signed into law, it actually prohibited organ procurement organizations from procuring organs from individuals infected with HIV. And the reason for that was actually at the time, I think, was really designed to protect the public. We didn't really understand HIV. We knew AIDS was deadly. There were a lot of concerns about how it is transmitted and other things. And so in an effort to protect the general public, that was written into law. And it wasn't until a number of years ago, a colleague of ours named Elmi Mueller, who's a kidney transplant surgeon in South Africa, began to use HIV-infected deceased donors to transplant HIV-infected end-stage renal disease patients. And that really came about because Elmi had sort of a problem on her hands, and that is that in South Africa, there actually are not enough dialysis machines for everyone who needs dialysis. And so every day they have to make decisions about who they're going to offer dialysis to and who they're not. And if you have kidney failure and you're not able to get dialysis, you'll die. And so because HIV patients historically had not done well in South Africa, they were actually denied dialysis. And so Elmi noted that and wanted to make a difference. And she thought, you know, every year we have HIV-infected individuals who die. Well, why not use kidneys from those individuals to transplant these HIV-infected end-stage patients? And so she received ethical approval from her university and support and did that. And Elmi was the first person in the world to demonstrate that you could take a kidney from an HIV-infected deceased donor and transplant that into an HIV-infected recipient and get really good outcomes. And so Elmi has been able to make a big difference in the lives of HIV-infected individuals in South Africa. And so if you fast forward a bit to the U.S., what we have in the U.S., similar to many places in the world, is a supply and demand problem. We have, you know, over 100,000 individuals currently waiting for a deceased donor transplant, and we only perform about 18,000 kidney transplants in the U.S. every year. And so the question is, how could we go about finding alternative sources of organs? And so the thought of potentially being able to use HIV-positive deceased donors to transplant HIV-infected recipients seemed like a win-win. It helps the HIV-infected person achieve transplant, and it also frees up an uninfected kidney for someone on the general waiting list who doesn't have HIV. And that was really what motivated many of us to pursue having the National Organ Transplant Act amended. And we were able to do that with bipartisan support, and we were able to get the HIV Organ Policy Equity Act, or the HOPE Act, passed into law, and President Obama signed that into law, making for the first time it legal for organ procurement organizations to procure organs from HIV-infected donors for the sole purpose of transplanting HIV-infected end-stage renal disease patients.
What safeguards to ensure HIV-infected organs are kept separate and not mistakenly transplanted into uninfected patients?
Well, we use the same protocols and practices that we do throughout healthcare in the United States in terms of proper personal protective equipment, proper labeling, proper handling of tissues. You know, for many, many years in the United States, we have been procuring organs from hepatitis C infected individuals for the sole purpose of transplanting hepatitis C infected candidates. And so we use the same practices that we've used for hepatitis C for the last 25 years. We apply those same practices in the setting of HIV.
And what are some of the criteria for patient selection? And also, what are some of the criteria for donor selection?
Well, for patient selection, it's really important that individuals demonstrate compliance. And that's not unique to HIV patients. We require that of all potential transplant candidates. But one measure of that in an HIV-infected individual is that they have a negative viral load. So when they are able to maintain negative viral loads, it suggests that they're very compliant with their antiretroviral medications, which is critically important in the transplant setting. We also like to make sure that they don't have any active infections. Again, that same criteria applies to uninfected patients as well, considering transplant. You know, you don't want to put a transplant in someone and give them immunosuppression if they're actively infected with other with bacteria or viruses and things like that. And so those are sort of the very basic requirements. So they have to be relatively healthy and free of opportunistic infections. They have to have a negative viral load, and they have to be on a stable antiretroviral treatment and in the care of an HIV provider.
Do you have some strategies for immunosuppression?
We do. We've studied immunosuppression in this population extensively because one of the things we learned from the NIH clinical trial is that almost counterintuitively, HIV-infected kidney transplant recipients have much higher acute rejection rates than their uninfected counterparts. And so when we studied this, we realized that if we use lymphocyte-depleting induction therapies, that we can really significantly lower the risk for acute rejection in this population. And so that is a very much a critical part of our protocol here at UAB so that we can make sure that we lower their risk for acute rejection.
What about management of comorbidities?
Sure, that's a great question. You know, all of our transplant recipients, independent of where they at, whether or not they have HIV, are plagued with many comorbidities. Many of them come to transplant with them, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, hyperlipidemia. HIV-infected individuals are at especially high risk because many of the antiretroviral medications that they take to suppress their viral loads increases cardiovascular disease, increases things like high cholesterol and things like that. And so for those patients, we aggressively treat those conditions with things like statins. People have probably heard of things like Lipitor, things like that have been shown to decrease cardiovascular morbidity and mortality.
And Dr. Locke, in just the last few minutes, how can a community physician refer a patient to UAB Medicine?
We have both a website on our transplant website as well as a 1-800 number. We're happy to take any referral for any patient. If you have anybody that has end-stage renal disease, we're happy to evaluate them and make the determination whether or not they're a transplant candidate so we can take that burden from you. And we can really be partners together in this and try to help as many people as possible.
And now tell us about your team. Why is UAB so great to work with?
I think you said it best when you described it as a team. I'm certainly the one speaking today, but I just represent an entire group of people that I think have been really, really dedicated to helping this vulnerable population. There's been a lot of heavy lifting. It started with having to get a law changed, all the way to building in the appropriate protocols and safeguards to make this a reality for our patients. We also, I think, benefit from tremendous institutional support. I can't say enough about that. It's just an incredible place, I think, to work. And I think for our patients, it's an incredible place to come and be taken care of. It really is very much like a big family. And I think myself and my colleagues really consider it a privilege to be able to take care of people.
Thank you so much, Dr. Locke. What a fascinating topic. You're listening to UAB Medcast, and for more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.